You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, open source, grassroots, community-inspired, and community-motivating radio. And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with me is my co-host and mom, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. Another beautiful day. I'm predicting we're going to have a cool summer.
Really?
We'll see what happens.
That's not what anybody else is predicting. Where do you get your prediction, Mom?
We had a warm winter, didn't we?
We did. And that's why everybody thinks we're going to have a...
hot summer. We'll see.
Sweltering summer. Yeah. But I'll go with your prediction. My mom's always right.
Moms are always right.
Wow. When did that happen?
That happens when we get older, and moms are right. But when we're a teenager, you're always wrong.
Yeah. Right. Well, so. I don't remember us ever having too much difficulty.
That's because you left me alone. I mean, not in a bad way.
Right, right.
In a good way.
Gotcha.
In a good way, yeah. You let me figure things out for myself. That was a good thing.
Okay,
so.
Good.
So
that was my mother's approach, too, so. Yeah. I came by it naturally, as my grandma used to say.
Yeah. We'll have to ask my daughter if she thinks I did the same thing or not.
Yeah.
I might have been meddling a little too much. I don't know. Well, Mom, why don't you tell our listeners about our guest today?
We have a most unusual, interesting guest today is Frank Mink, the author of Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead, co-authored by Jody M. Roy, PhD. Frank's violent childhood in South Philadelphia primed him to hate. By 16, he was one of the most notorious skinhead gang leaders on the East Coast. By 18, he was doing hard time in Illinois prison. Shortly after being paroled, he defected from the white supremacy movement. The Oklahoma City bombing inspired him to try to stop the hatred he had once felt. He began speaking on behalf of the Anti-Defamation League and appeared on MTV and other national networks in his efforts to stop the hate. Boy.
Yeah, what a story.
And he's still trying.
Yeah,
he's still trying.
Still kicking.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Frank.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Frank came to Writer's Voices in a rather unusual way.
Right.
Driving through town a month or so ago.
Yep.
Heard us on the radio. And it was a day, Mom, that you weren't able to come because of weather. It was, and he heard me say that you weren't coming, and he thought maybe there was an opening right at that moment.
Yeah.
But actually, our guest was on the air, but Mom wasn't here. So we decided this was too good an opportunity to pass up.
You bet.
Yeah. I sat in the lobby and just listened to the interview and waited for you. And
yeah, that was wonderful. It was really actually... very gratifying to me to know that people are listening.
Right.
That we can have an impact, that we can make a difference.
No, and it was great because I really wanted to come to Fairfield anyway. I was driving through, coming from St. Louis back to Des Moines, and just was listening. So it was great, and I was going to come in to Fairfield anyway. So.
And you had given a speech just like the day before at Western Illinois University.
Yes.
Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Do you do a lot of touring and speaking?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things I do a lot of. And it's funny to you, I either do colleges or I do like juvenile detention centers or prisons.
Is there much difference?
The juvenile detention centers and prisons are much more into it because they know that I'm one of them.
Mm.
And,
oh, of course.
But the college students, it's... If you ever even like look up any of my speeches on YouTube, they're all from colleges, and it's very raunchy, funny, a lot of curses, and you know, just the way I would normally talk if we were just free flowing anyway, you know.
Right.
So
right.
And so yeah, I do a lot of both. So, and I also, you know, I work in television, so I live out in Los Angeles and do all that stuff too. So
a varied career.
And yes.
You had a varied life.
Right. I mean, I've worked, if I gave you my resume, you would think, who is, you know, I worked for professional hockey teams in my life. I've worked in professional, in talk radio, on the conservative talk radio station. I was a producer. And so, I mean, I just had a pretty, interesting, crazy life still, you know, and I still do.
And now I kind of got the impression you're still working in professional hockey, or is that not the case?
No, I was working for the team in Des Moines,
okay.
Which was an American Hockey League team, which are the farm team of a bigger club, so
okay.
Anaheim Ducks, the Dallas Stars. So I worked for those two organizations, but now there's no team there. They left. So.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they moved to Syracuse.
Okay.
Curse you, East Coast. So
yeah, that's quite a ways from Des Moines,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. So.
So, it's hard to know where to start exactly because, you know, your story is so captivating, but and it covers a lot of ground.
No.
Let's, you know, do you want to just kind of give a summary of what the book is about?
Yeah, I mean, the book is about, I was a kid, I grew up in South Philadelphia and pretty rough neighborhood, as I say.
That's a rough neighborhood.
Yeah, and I grew up in the Irish section, which was pretty, you know, and our neighborhood was so Irish, there's this funny joke, because my real last name isn't Mink. My real last name is, and actually it's an Italian last name, it's Bertolini. And my mother moved back to the Irish neighborhood with this, as they would say, in my neighborhood and my family. She came back with a little Dago kid in tow, which was me. And so going to the Catholic church there and then being in that old Irish neighborhood, they kind of, my mom had changed my last name back to her old maiden name because they didn't want me growing up in an Irish neighborhood with an Italian last name because it's such kind of a rough area for that. So, you know, but, you know, just
now,
live
that
happen.
Animosity still exist there, the Irish-Italian animosity, or is that
it kind of does. No. I mean, it's still, you know, there's still a lot of slang towards each other. But, you know, we live two blocks away from each other. So there's always intermingling. There's family and friends. But there's still the, you know, the stereotypes that everyone will say and stuff like that. So
yeah, kind of an underlying thing that right.
It's just the way, you know, we're off the boat from each other. We're all related. I mean, we really are. I mean, I remember as a kid, I would tell my grandma, I'd be like, oh, I really like Susie Q. You know, she'd say, Susie Q from 4th Street? And I say, yeah. She'd go, that's your cousin. That's your third cousin from the boat, you incest little son of a gun, you know. So
you couldn't hardly win, could you?
No, you never win. So you couldn't date in the neighborhood. You can't date outside the neighborhood. So...
that's why you came to Iowa.
Right. No. Yeah. So, but, you know, I grew up with a single mother. Not a sob story, but the truth. You know, we struggled at times. Mm-hmm. I remember as a kid, but I was always never noticed that we were struggling. I wasn't one of those kids. You know, I remember sometimes being on public assistance, and then I remember my mom having another child, and we were on WIC and stuff, and kind of being embarrassed sometimes of having to spend like the food stamps at the store as a kid, you know, pulling out the old neon colored money at the stores was embarrassing as a kid, and you hated that. And but
that was the least of your problems,
right? I mean, then my mom gets remarried to a drunk who hates my guts. He's now started a family with my mother, and I was this oddball out. I was a Dago kid, and he was an Irish guy from the neighborhood, and hated that my mom had this relationship with an outsider, and would take it out on me, and it got pretty physical and abusive. And I remember as a kid, and this is where when I do this talk to juvenile detention centers, they get it. Yous might not get it, and college kids don't get it. My goal every day was to get hit by a car. That was my goal as a kid because I didn't want to go home anymore. I mean, I hated going to my house. So I figured if I just got hit by a car, I'll at least go to a hospital. Like, you're not going to die in South Philly by a car hitting you because we live in them small, narrow streets. Everyone gets hit by a car. I mean, it's just a thing to do.
Okay.
So, you know.
So did you get hit by
a car? I never got hit by a car in my life. And I'm the only kid that wanted to get hit by the car. But it's self-preservation. You know, that's really what it was. And when you read my book, you'll see that I was an athlete. I was always an athlete. I was always the star athlete. Even when I played on all black teams, I was always the star. It was my legs would not let me get hit by a car because they were so fast. I was unbelievably fast as a kid, like faster than all the older boys in my neighborhood, faster than all my older cousins. And my legs would say, get out of this.
Well, that probably saved your life in more ways than
all the time. Many times over. Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
So then I move in with my dad after my stepfather kicked me out. And
you were what, 13?
13. And I had to go to an all-black school at this time now because I went from a mixed school, a diverse school, to not diverse. They might call schools that are mostly all-black diverse, but there was no diversity. It was black kids.
You were the diverse.
Yeah, I was the diverse. And
The token white kid.
Yeah, and it was a rough school. I mean, it's a rough school period. In fact, they just closed that school down. It's called Pepper Middle School. You can look it up. Google it in Philadelphia. Pepper Middle School is right by the airport. And it was just a rough, violent school, and the administration always kind of turned a blind eye to it. You know, when you talk about bullying today, when we would get bullied, I remember I would fist fight with kids. The administration, the teachers, you know, whoever else in the administration would come and just break up the fight and then walk away and leave me standing there with the four guys that was just getting jumped by. Like, come on, leave the white kid alone. And then they walk away. Just leave me standing there with them again. I mean, it was
so you
horrible.
Didn't last there very long.
No, I started leaving school. Yeah. I cut school pretty quickly. And Philadelphia school district so bad that they still graduated me. I missed the last 40 days of school, and they still moved me into high school because they were like, you're old enough. And I was a D student at best, a D student. And I missed the last 40 days of school, and they still graduated me. So that summer, I went up into Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where my cousins had lived.
I found it interesting that Lancaster is where you were introduced to the skinhead movement. My family's from Lancaster.
Okay.
Yeah, my father's family was there for 11 generations.
Are they Amish?
They were Mennonite.
Okay.
They were the founding, Hans Herr is like the founding person of Lancaster County.
Yeah, Hans Herrhaus is the oldest inland structure.
They came from Europe, got a land grant from William Penn, and started there. My maiden name was Herr. There's a lot of Herrs.
Herr's Chips.
Yeah,
as it goes back to that family, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and it never, you know, we left there, moved to Iowa when I was 13, almost 14, but it never occurred to me that there would be even be a skinhead or a clan. There was a clan in Lancaster County. It never occurred to me that
it was
could
huge
even
there.
Exist.
Well,
really?
I mean, when I first got up there, my cousins who were originally from South Philly, who bought a home up there, my uncle did anyway, they lived on this long road, and there was two normal families, and all the rest were Amish. And one was a Mennonite because I think they had a tractor. So they would have to be a Mennonite if they had a tractor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I remember thinking, I remember as a kid going to the reenactments of the Revolution, you know, living in Philadelphia, and thinking, are these people reenacting this? Or is this the way they really live? And they really turn butter, you know, like they turn butter. And so it was like National Geographic stuff to me. Like it really was to see cows. And I mean, I never cut a blade of grass until I moved to Iowa. You know, growing up in South Philly, there is no grass. Not legal grass, anyway, you know. So so when I moved here, it was different. But anyway, moving to Lancaster for the summer, my cousin was an old punk rocker. And when I say old, he was 16 at the time. I was going on 14. So to me, he was old and cool. And, you know, his friends drove cars. And that summer when I went up there, he wasn't a punk rocker anymore. He was into the skinhead thing. So when these skinheads would all start talking about multiracial society, because they also all come hang out at my cousin's house, and they'd come sneak up in the middle of the night, bring beer and girls, and they were cool. They were tattooed, and I said, wow, these guys are cool. And they would always, my cousin would always say, hey, you know, they're always talking about multiculturalism, and I'm like, whatever, I don't know what that means. But when they start talking about blacks and whites, I'm like, oh, listen, I went to school. Yeah. And so my cousin would always vow, you know, he'd always say, yeah, man, my cousin, he lives in a really rough part of Philly, especially when my dad's neighborhood. He's like, man, he lives in a real, so all these skinhead kids would always be like, what's it really like? Philly to them, Philadelphia was like the mystical city. And now I'm like, yeah, it's horrible. I mean, I hate it. You know, and I did. I hated everything. So I hated my life at the time. So finally, one night, all the skinheads had brought me to this concert with them. And as we were at this concert, this bigger skinhead put me on his shoulders.
And you still had your long hair then.
Still had my long hair. I was not a skinhead yet.
Yeah.
So we go in and they start beating people up. And this big skinhead guy would hold people. Now you got to know now, this is 1989. So they're beating up other white people in these clubs. It's Lancaster, so it's all white people. And they're beating up white people with the mullets, because that was the big white haircut at the time, was the mullet was just coming out. And so they were getting beat up, and that's rightfully so. I mean, it's a pretty bad haircut. So as they're beating up these guys with the mullets, we get kicked out. And that after the club had gotten done with, all these guys were coming out that we were trying to beat up, and they were like basically running from us in a way. So so we caught up to one of them, the one guy that I was trying to help beat up when I was in the club before I got kicked out. And my buddy, this big farm boy, he was like, hey, you got something to say to us now? And this big mullet guy was like, no, I never had anything to say to you from the get-go. You started beating me up. And I seen it for the first time. I seen it. He had fear. He feared us.
Yeah.
Now, he really didn't fear me. I was about maybe 5'5 at the time. But I seen it, and I loved it. Because up into that moment, and this is no excuse for my actions, but this is the truth. Up into that moment, I feared everything. I feared my home life. I feared my father's house. I feared my mom's house. I feared school. I feared if I was going to have enough food to eat. And now someone fears me. Bet. This is on. I loved it. Mm-hmm. And that night they asked me to shave my head, and I was like, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So.
And that's how it happens. That's sometimes. I mean, in many cases, that's how the converts become skinheads, probably.
Oh yeah, I mean it's the whole sense of belonging. It's the same thing as a gang. I mean, it is to the T, except for you're using your racial pride, this false pride, but this racial, you know, the white race is better than everyone else, instead of saying in a gang where you say, "Oh, well, our neighborhood's better than everyone else." You know, I mean, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm a broken human being going into this thing, broken, and so. That night I joined, and from there I started to learn about things that they would teach me. The Federal Reserve. Again, I'm 14 years old, and they're teaching me about the Federal Reserve and left wing and right wing and the Jews. I mean, I don't know any Jews. I never hated Jews in my life. I don't know any Jews in South Philly. But when they start talking about the Federal Reserve is secretly run by Israel and the Jews, I was like, okay, like, I get this. Like, see, and it goes back to all them jokes you had always heard as a kid. When someone said, don't Jew me. Or how do you start a Jewish parade? You roll a penny down the street. Now all them jokes started clicking in my head. Like, oh, I get why my uncle said that joke one time. Oh, I get why I heard someone say, don't Jew me. Oh, they're all stingy, you know, and this matched with what they were saying. So it felt like it was unlocking something to me.
And I thought you'd discovered the truth.
The truth. And that's what they're telling you, you are. They're telling you, you've been lied to your whole life. You watch MTV, you watch this, you're being duped by the Jewish media. And now here we're revealing that really secretly the Jews had this secret organization of Zionist occupational government, and they run everything.
I want to make it clear, if someone's just tuning in, that this is not what you believe now.
No, absolutely not. I'm trying to show you that why a right, kid yeah, would right, believe yeah, it. Right, if I just right. came in here and said, oh, they just told me to hate Jews because they save pennies, and people say, what an idiot. But I'm saying they're proving to me that what my parents or my uncles had jokingly said meant something, and that was unlocking. I wanted to be an adult. See, the age of 14, and now in my life, I go around the world, and I've been blessed. And I've spoken to groups of all former Islamic extremists, former IRA bombers I've been in groups with, to channel peace now. The one thing that always comes up is the age of 14, especially in males, because it's that time in your life where you're supposed to man up. Everyone's telling you, man up, but also listen to your parents. And I'm getting conflicted information here. So am I supposed to separate from my parents and go on my own now? Or am I supposed to still listen and respect my parents? And I don't respect my parents because they were both, at the time, drug addict alcoholics. So I don't want to respect them. So now I'm going to take whatever this path is and go with it.
Well, at that age, the impulse factor is not yet developed in your brain either. So you can't think ahead of what this might cause then in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no what's tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's what can I get today?
Right.
How can I eat today? How can I drink alcohol? You know, because by the age of 15, I'm a full-fledged alcoholic as I get into this skinhead thing. And I become pretty indoctrinated pretty quickly and want to preach to the world. And I did. I mean, my family started, even my good family, the family, my aunts and uncles that always loved me no matter what, started not inviting me places anymore.
I understand that.
Right. I mean, because all my conversations, you could say, hey, how's math class? Oh, I don't do math because Jews run math. You know, like, I was crazy. So my family started, oh, my God. You know, and they stopped, like, inviting me places. And so now this more becomes my family. And I'm going to live or die for this. And I really believe that. Like, I was ready to live or die and planning out race wars and going on. And, you know, as I move out to Illinois, because I'm wanted by the police in Philadelphia, so I'm on the run. I make my way out to Springfield, and now I start getting my own cable access show to recruit people. I was doing media outlets for the movement.
How did that come about?
You know, it's one of those things. One day they asked for a smart young racist, this TV show did, the first time. This was a national televised show on ABC.
Uh-huh.
So my group sent me. They're like, oh, here you go, here's our smart guy. You know, kind of smart, whatever.
smarter than the average bear.
Anyway. Smarter than the average bear, but I was also dumb enough to go on the show.
because now you're telling the whole world that you are a racist skinhead,
yeah,
and probably have done things illegal.
Yeah. So I mean, I was just one of those guys. I mean, when there was someone who needed retribution from us, I was one of the guys the people would go to and say, "Hey, can you go napalm this guy's car? Can you go do this to his house? Can you go whatever the violent thing might have been?" And I was always, sure, this is my life. See, I was all run by ego. See, that built my ego. See, I had no self-esteem. Mm-hmm. You know, not to get to the end of it, but I have no self-esteem. So anything that builds my ego, I want part of.
Yeah.
And that's what that was doing.
Well, you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Frank Mink, the author of Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. Now, Frank, there must have been something in you all along, though, that didn't quite buy into what you were being taught and even what you were living, because, and the reason I say this is because you had several episodes of depression and suicidal tendencies to get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that maybe was partially your better self saying, this is the wrong way, we got to do something, you got to change. Do you think that was the case?
You know, it might have been, but I didn't feel it that way at the time. I mean, I really, like, there are some suicide attempts in the book, even when I was a skinhead and things were going good for me as a skinhead. I don't know if that makes any sense, but...
As things go for skinheads.
Yeah, so, wow. But, I mean, I was a lonely individual. No matter if I was standing in a group of 100 skinheads, I was lonely.
You're still lonely.
Yeah. And so I don't know if the good tendencies were trying to show off in that way, but maybe they are. Maybe if I sat down with a head guru, they might tell me this.
Yeah. Well, I've often thought, and based on no particular evidence, but that depression and mental illness sometimes is our own way of saying that there's something about the way that we're living or our belief system, where we profess some belief that on the inside we know isn't really true, and there's a conflict.
You're fighting with yourself.
Fighting with yourself, yeah. And that's what can cause.
You know, and I think too, as I'm starting to, when I go to prison and I'm starting to play more sports with people and had some closer bonds with other guys who were not my color but were the same age as me, and they were urban kids from like Chicago and East St. Louis, and I was this Philly kid who hung out with all the white guys. It wasn't like American History X where I stopped hanging with the Aryans. I still hung with the Aryans, but I also went and played sports with a lot of the black guys because they were good and I wanted good competition, and I was 18 years old, I didn't smoke cigarettes I was still in tip-top shape, and was faster than everybody else even in there.
And when you're in prison, were you sober?
I mean, occasionally. There's times I got on, don't get me wrong. I mean, there's times, even in the book, I talk about one of the times I got transferred from one prison to another was because I was selling, because you always have to make money in prison, not just the prison job, but if you're in a gang, I was in the Aryans, not the Aryan Brotherhood, I was in the Aryan Nations, which were kind of the same thing, but...
I was going to say, what's the difference?
Aryan Brotherhood are men that usually get involved in the gang in prison. And Aryan Nations are usually people that were already involved in the movement on the outside.
Oh, okay.
So you have a different kind of category of who you are.
Hierarchy, as it
were. Yeah. So I was always earning stuff. Well, one day, the guy to pay me off, I was making money, and this Latin King guy, a gang of the Latin Kings, their chief was paying me back by smoking a joint with me. Now, I never really smoked weed in my life. I mean, I think I tried it once as a kid with the neighborhood boys, but never felt anything. And now this guy's like, hey, I'll smoke with you. And I was like, all right. Smoking in my cell, and here comes some guards on our tier. So we were trying to get all the smoke out of our cell, you know, before they got to my cell. And he got out of my cell as quick as possible and ran to his cell. And left me there. And the next day I got a letter. It said, come to Eternal Affairs. You know, and it just has my prison number. And I go down to Eternal Affairs the next day, and I hand my letter over. There's a guy sitting at a table waiting for it at a bunch of hearings that day. And they just look at my thing, and they look at where, you know, whatever the charge was. It didn't tell me, but they knew the code. And they said, oh, okay, here, you got to pee in this cup for us. And I knew that I was dirty. So I was like, I can't pee in that cup. And the guy goes, why not? I said, religious reasons. He goes, what religion's that? I said, I don't know, dude, the kind I can't pee in a cup, that's all I know. So they transferred me from that prison to another max prison to get me out of the prison. So, and I was a troublemaker, even
because they thought, this is a bad guy, we'll get rid of him.
Yeah, that's what, well, they just transfer you around because they think you're making too many connections, whatever. And
is it, when you get to a new place, is it tough till you get your self-established kind of?
No, I was always established. All the Aryans knew who I was. Yeah, if that sounded right, but due to the fact that the cable access show in the state of Illinois, so everyone knew me from the cable access show. So I was kind of a little racist slipper.
You had a rep before you ever went to prison then.
Yeah, I had roadies and all. So
roadies?
But no, people had known of me. There was, you know, people who had heard of me and knew of me and knew that I was, to them, an intelligent racist because I had the TV show. And so it wasn't just one of these guys, I hate black people. Like, I had these reasons, and I could tell you, you know, we're separated by continents for a reason. You know, I had all this stuff in my head that I would just spout out. I'll tell you a real quick story about how I became the most intelligent racist in prison. So on top of my head, I have a tattoo that says made in Philly. Now that's where my parents did it at. So I really am made in Philadelphia. So I'm walking and I just got my head shaved again upstate when I was upstate prison. I got my hair cut back and this black guy who dressed, there's men in prison, not just black men, but there's men in prison who dress like women. That's how they live their lives. They change, what have you. So they call them the queens. Well, this black queen is walking down the steps, and I'm walking up the steps, and the black queen goes to me, what's that say on your head? And I said, oh, it says made in Philly. I'm from South Philly. And she goes, oh, I'm from South Chicago. I'm from Southside Chicago. I said, wow, what a coincidence. You know? And I kept on walking, and she was just like, oh, okay. Next day, she goes to see me. I'm standing with all my Aryans, and she's going to pay me back for being rude to her. And she goes, hey, skinhead, what's up? You're cute. Now, it's the first time anyone in the joint is calling me cute. And let alone it's a guy who looks like a girl.
Okay.
So the Aryan guy at the time says, how about that, Frank? Real loud in front of everyone. He goes, how about that, Frank? The master race takes over. He's getting shot twice. He's black and he's gay. Now, let's go over this comment. When the master race takes over, it's used widely in the movement. When the master race takes over, it's always, you know, blah, blah, blah is going to happen. The master race takes over. It's never anything good. It's never like when the master race takes over, there's going to be baby bunnies and petunias. It's always really bad stuff.
Excuse me.
So he says, when the master race takes over, he's going to get shot twice. He's black and he's gay. And I looked at him and I said, no, guys, that's good. I said, if he's black and he's gay, that's good. And all the Aryans were like, yo, we don't know what you're like on the East Coast, but here we're not down with the gay thing. And I said, no, I'm not neither, but if he's black and he's gay, he's not going to be with a woman. He's not going to reproduce his race. And it took them all a minute to figure out that I was a genius for figuring that out. I was probably one of the smartest cookies I'd seen in a while. And so from that point on, I was one of the gurus of racism towards our group.
Uh-huh.
So,
is there, looking back on it, is there anything positive that came out of your being in the, you know, being a skinhead, being in the Aryan Nation?
You know, I mean, there's definitely a positive message in the fact that I can use what I'm doing now, because one of the things I do in my life is I help get people out of it, or people that are treading that line. There's kids at like high school, if they're getting in trouble for writing a swastika at their school and writing Hi Hitler, and but have really no clue
what
but they think it's kind of cool. And I'm the one that they call in, and I will spend the day with a person, and I will take them and meet people out. And that's what I do. I do like these interventions, but it's different than like saying, hey, do you want help? And if not, you know, we're going to cut ties. No, I keep showing him people. So, and that's only due to my experience. Sometimes your experience is your greatest asset in a way.
Right.
So
everything that happened is part of what created who you are today.
Yeah, and do I regret it? I mean, there's huge parts of the whole thing. Harming other human beings that I did, which was on a pretty regular basis, and I was harmed too, but that's not an excuse for my actions, is sometimes the things that will even make me question, do I deserve good things in my life today? Because I'll say, I was such a horrible human being when I was 16, 17, I mean, and then, you know, I start to question it. But then I have good people in my life who say, no, you deserve what you do today to get to today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what keeps me going, you know, if the karma issue comes up.
Well, you know, there's something to that, of course. But you had to learn the hard way.
Yeah.
And, you know, came up the hard way. So then you appreciate what you have now.
Absolutely.
And that's the difference, you see. You do appreciate it.
You know, it can come down even to daily occurrences with just my wife, you know, or we're struggling for money for something, you know, we got to pay a bill soon, and my wife, and even I sometimes, but I don't stress, but she'll be stressed out, like, oh my God, you know, how are we going to get this paid, or, you know, we have to have this money by this time, and I always think, you know what, we have a roof over our head, we have food on the food in the refrigerator, our kids are happy, we're okay, you know, if... You know, if we don't go on that cruise or whatever my wife is threading about, you know, we're going to be okay.
Okay, I don't know if I should ask you this, but do you ever fear your former associates?
Fear? No, I don't. I can't live my life by fear. I just can't.
No, you've been there.
Fear will drive you wrong.
Yeah.
So I have faith. I have hope.
But you may be wary.
I'm wary, and I protect myself, and we go to far lengths to protect ourselves.
Okay.
Because you're publicly...
out there.
Yeah.
But I also, even if you read my book, I don't throw the neo-Nazi movement under the bus. I never throw... I talk about myself.
Right.
I do.
Yeah.
And I truly... And I never say, look at them guys, they're such idiots. Or even when I deal with some of the neo-Nazi groups today, when I happen to have a... communication, if they're open to communication and they can keep it civil, to even have an argument with them or anyone that you would totally disagree with, you still first step in that is you have to go back and see why do they truly believe this and believe that it's real to them.
Right.
Because if you don't, then you have no, then you're just going to argue, you're not going to debate, you're not going
to, you have to respect that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, and I totally respect that. I don't believe that all racists are idiots. There are incidents in this world where people will call a guy a racist where I won't. Where a guy, you know, someone will say, I had to move out of that neighborhood because my kids were going to school and the school was becoming all black and it was getting more violent at the school. And people say, oh, so you're a racist. That's not a guy that, to me, is a racist.
No.
I think it's a guy who's a good dad who said, you know, the school that my kids used to go to is now changing and it's changing for the worse.
It's a self-preservationist.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, that's... true, and some people don't want to hear that. They especially some of the civil rights groups and the people that I work with, they don't like when I say these type of comments because they want to hurry up and label everything that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that it's true that a guy can do that.
Yeah, Of course, the issue is that why aren't the school districts paying attention to those schools and making sure that they're safe, regardless of what the composition of the racial composition.
Absolutely. And it does fall back on this. The cities, the administrations, the school boards, it falls back on them.
And, you know, schools in rich neighborhoods have a lot more money than schools in poor neighborhoods. It really should be the other way around.
Right.
Because the rich kids have all kinds of other resources for development, and the kids in the poor neighborhoods may not.
They don't.
And so that should be where our public funds are going, more in that direction.
Absolutely.
Not
it's completely reversed, as
right.
you said. The lower income taxes in them neighborhoods get the lower income school, and they just stay that way.
Yeah.
And for a kid to succeed, that's why even like a kid like myself, when I was a kid, if I would succeed, people say, "Oh, look where he came from." For him to succeed, he has to really be double what the other kids have to do because it's almost handed to them. So it's a harder standard. And but it always goes back to two is the parenting of a child. You know, I was never reinforced. See, like when I said when my skinheads would talk to me about my life, when I went home, neither my mom or my dad or my step parents ever said to me when I walked in the door, "How's Frank today? How's school? Hey, how's that math test you have to? How's that going?"
They never even knew you had a math test,
right.
Even if you were in school,
right. So it goes back to the parenting.
But you did have some positive adult influences in your life as a child.
I did. I had some great uncles and some great aunts. My grandparents on both sides, my mother's side and my father's side, were tremendous to me.
Uh-huh. Extended family.
Even in writing my book, because they all got interviewed for the book, not by me, by my writer. That's why I had another person help me write it, because I didn't want to interview people about me, because they're all going to say, well, sometimes you're really mean and hateful, but you're such a nice guy. Like, I didn't want that. I wanted them to tell my writer, you know, there was times where he was just off the hook. you know, my uncles would say, we've seen it, but we just didn't know what to do. And I get that,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They didn't have the tools. They didn't know. Right. They didn't know I was getting the crap beat out of me at home by my stepdad, you know? And this is my dad's uncles, my big Italian family, who, you know, would have went down and broke his legs for me.
Yeah.
And they were like, we didn't know, you know, because I didn't share that stuff with people. I didn't want to look weak.
Now, unfortunately, I didn't get to read the entire book.
Oh, I'm out of here.
Close to the beginning. I read the end. And, I mean, I read about two-thirds through and then the end because I ran out of time. But it does seem like you made peace with your mother as an adult.
Well, I've made peace with everyone.
Everyone.
You know, here, there's...
I mean, to me, the things great. That she did were that's almost great. Unforgivable.
You know, she's my mom. And even to this day, and this is what people can take from this, my mom still to this day doesn't call. My daughter just had her third birthday. My mom don't call. You know, she's still stuck in her... My dad don't call. They just don't. They're just not them type of... So for me to go through my life thinking that one day they're going to call is unreasonable expectations. It's unreasonable for me to think that they're going to change being who they are because I want them to be that way. They never have done it before. So if I lower my expectations on who they're going to be or just expect what I expect, and that is that they're not going to call.
Now, were you afraid that you would not be able to break that pattern with your own kids, that you would be the same kind of parent?
Oh.
You know, that because you learn parenting from the parenting you got. How did you do that? How did you break that pattern to become an attentive, loving parent?
Well, I had to get sober first. When I got out of the movement, we weren't allowed to do drugs in the movement. No, a lot of drinking. So, again, 15, full-fledged alcoholic. Not an excuse for my actions, just the truth. After I got out of the movement, I started getting into painkillers and Oxycontin and then heroin and dabbled and became an addict. So my main thing is if I stay sober, I'll be a better parent anyway. But the point of that is, what I'm getting at is, I learned by making mistakes as a parent. Now I watch my uncles and I see how they parent. I see how my grandparents, like, because now I'm old enough, I can say, look back on moments where they were parenting me, or I watched them parent my uncles. And my in-laws are like my mother and father to me. And they give me tips on how to parent their grandchildren. I'm blessed in the in-laws I have. They're not overbearing. They're not underbearing. They'll give us suggestions, but they won't, you know, call me out. You make mistakes as parents, and I know that. So, you know, my first time I remember I wasn't a good parent, or I didn't know how to be a parent, was when my first daughter was born, when I just got out of the penitentiary. She was 6 months old, and I was supposed to get her for Easter. So for Easter, I went around the house, and I'm hiding Easter eggs, you know, the little plastic Easter eggs. Well, I'm hiding them on top of refrigerators.
For a six-month-old?
In a walker, you know, and thinking, ha, 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 she'll never find this one. And because I don't know, you know? I don't know.
That's a fairly harmless thing.
Right, but that was one of the moments in my life, like, oh, I don't know how to be a dad.
Wow.
I just don't. So I'm learning. I mean, I now have 5 children, so I'm, you know.
Better learn.
Yeah. I've been married for 11 years to a, you know, same woman. You know, been clean and sober for a long time. And there were some times in the beginning where I relapsed and things got bad, and my wife at the time stood by me and knew that there was something there, and that's all in the book. You know, I really give her a lot of credit for, you know, she always was afraid when the book was going to come out that people were going to think, people look at her stupid, like she was stupid for sticking by. And she was like, no, I wanted people to know that I always seen there was this thing in you, that once I'm sober, I just know that I can always accomplish anything. I might not have the greatest book smarts. I just don't. But I talk about it in the book when I had come to the conclusion through the O.J. Simpson trial, first off, the DNA, because I first started hearing about DNA, that we all have the same DNA. And that's where I came to the conclusion with the black friends that I made in prison and just life in general, things weren't clicking anymore for the movement. I started to realize I'm the black, Asian, Latino, and the white, okay, we're all equal, but I'm still going to hate the Jews. That
really?
Was my thing.
Until
I met this Jewish antique dealer,
mm-hmm.
who gave me a job when nobody else would. I mean, I had a big swastika tattooed on my neck. And this guy was like, I don't care what you believe, just don't break my furniture. You know? And he was that way. And Keith was Jewish looking, very East Coast, ugh, oy vey, you know, like just was like that. Didn't wear a yarmulke or anything, but was Jewish. And I remember the first time he paid me, I thought in my head, in my anti-Semitic way, he's going to Jew me. And he came up and he paid me. He owed me $300. He gave me the $300 he owed me. And he gave me an extra $100. He's like, you're really good work. And all I thought was, you son of a gun. You're ruining it, you know.
You shot it, right?
Yeah. And then he gave me a full-time job after that. And the point of this was, I was driving a truck one day. And now this is something, again, a lot of people don't get. But when you talk to juvenile detention centers and prisons, they get this. See, I might have had the biggest ego in the world, but I had no self-esteem. So if I did something and broke something, my first thing is, oh, I'm so stupid. I used to always say, oh, I'm so stupid. One day I said it in front of Keith after working for the guy for 6 months. Still full-fledged neo-Nazi, swastika, boots, shaved head, the whole thing. So he grips me up one day after I said I was stupid, and he goes, stop saying you're stupid, you idiot. Get in the car, let's go. I'll get in the truck. So we get in the truck, and he unloads on me about how smart I am, how I'm one of the most smartest people he's ever met. And I think he's one of the smartest people because he runs this business, and wow. And he's just unloading on me. He's like, you could do whatever you want. He's like, you have something that people can't pay for. And I'll never forget how embarrassed I was that I had my boots on that day. And just embarrassed. Wow. This was not... When I made the decision at that moment, I was done. This isn't my opinion. I could tell you that I know whatever higher power, and we can get up to my higher power. Whatever my higher power was in my life, it was the higher power, science, and human nature consistently kept proving this belief wrong to me, consistently kept slapping me in the head like, who are you to judge on my earth? How dare you? I mean, look at you.
Yeah,
you know, you're a criminal, thug, drug addict, alcoholic. You're going to judge the world?
Well, let me ask you this. I always just assumed that the neo-Nazi, or is that all what Aryan also calls them, neo-Nazis?
Yeah,
same thing.
Yeah.
Okay, that they revere Hitler and the Nazi movement. Is that true?
That's true.
They do. Okay.
Yes. Now, they believe that he was
all skinheads are neo-Nazi.
No, there's whole.
And I'd never heard of Sharps. Do you want to tell us what that is?
Well, that all goes back to the history of the skinheads. See, because not everyone that's a neo-Nazi is a skinhead. For one, there's neo-Nazis that are just normal Joe Schmo looking guys. But skinheads,
not necessarily violent.
And there has to be in their head some type of violence of future Eight. Race war, okay. or something. Yeah, okay. I mean, you can't be like a neo-Nazi and think that gardening is your hobby.
Okay.
Like, it's just not true. It's just and anyone that says it is lying. But. Skinhead started out in England in the 60s, early 60s. The mods were a movement at the time. The mods were, you know, mopedding type guys in England. And there's punk rock scenes just starting to really flourish. And the skinheads were kind of like this working class English, almost nationalist in a way, like England for England, you know, English for England. And, but you could be black and be a skinhead back then. Because if you were black and you were from England, then you were allowed, you know, it was a very working class thing. Under working class, actually, lower working class. And there was just so many of them. And they were going to soccer games. They were hooligans. They were thugs. They were just these working class factory kids. And then the socialist movement and then the nationalist movement started to recruit the kids. And the socialists later on become the anti-racist skinheads. And the nationalists later on become the neo-Nazi skinheads.
And so Sharp is skinheads against racial prejudice.
Yes. And they're like a gang. That's an actual organization name, but there are just skinheads that are against racism that don't belong to any organization. So, but they're, you know, they're violent. It's a gang thing. We fight with them. They're not like peaceniks in a way. I get what they're saying. But then there's, like, especially in Iowa right now, there's a huge thing, what they call, there's a third branch of the skinheads called the trads, the traditional skinheads. And they're not sharp or neo-Nazis. They're just like the skinhead dress, the style, the clothing. I mean, it's its own fashion. It really
is.
It's
just a fashion statement.
I mean, Doc Martens didn't become famous until skinheads wore them. Flight jackets. I mean, a lot of the stuff that people wear today goes back to the early 80s skinhead push of fashion. I mean, really.
So if you see somebody dressed that way nowadays, you wouldn't necessarily make any conclusion about their political beliefs.
Well, you couldn't, but I could. Because, no, I can look at them. I can tell you within about a quarter of a mile, I can tell you what someone believes if they're dressed in skinhead garb. I can just tell you by certain pins that they're wearing, certain way, just
I mean, my son is almost 35 years old, and he shaved his head 10 years ago or more. Mm-hmm. But he's the most peaceful kid, young man that you'd ever hope to meet. Yeah, he doesn't hate anybody.
But he's not a skinhead, though.
He's not a skinhead. Right. And I don't know why he likes that hairstyle. But
I mean, I don't think the skinhead should corner the whole market on shaving heads, though. You know what I mean? So,
but they kind of have. That's the thing. You know, that's the first thing. Of course, that's the first thing you see.
Yeah. Yeah. But I see a lot of people in, you know, in private and public lives that are just shaved head people.
Honestly,
they're receding hairlines and they shave.
I think that was it. He had a receding hairline in his 20s.
And I'm going gray. You know, I think about it, but, you know, I got tattoos all over my head, so.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Frank Mink, the author of Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. And you can find out more about Frank at... what's your website?
FrankMink.com, or on Facebook, you can go to Autobiography Recovering Skinhead. That's the page I...
And Mink is spelled M-E-E-I-N-K.
Yes.
Right. So we only have about 12 minutes, so we need to talk fast here.
Yes.
Because there's a couple things that I want to talk to you about. One is the importance of sports in your life. How important is sports, do you think, in keeping kids on a good path?
You know, it's a huge part, and I've always, that's what how I got started in the real civil rights field, was getting more and more kids to play sports together. Because one, especially playing ice hockey, because, you know, hands down, no matter what we think politically, socially, I mean, the one fact is it's true is that hockey's the greatest sport on earth. I mean, there's just no arguing
it's
with
rough.
That. So,
it's rough.
So with that, it's one of the greatest team sports there is. It starts with the goalie to the defense to the forwards. And once you start teaching that, kids don't care, you know, as long as their teammates are working together. And when you put a kid in hockey equipment, I mean, they have cages on. You could barely tell what color of skin the kid is. You just know you have the same color jersey on. Mm-hmm. And sitting in a locker room, talking with a kid, learning stuff with kids, it's a huge deal.
So you've started a program for kids, ice hockey.
Yeah, Harmony Through Hockey. And right now with our team in moving to Syracuse, right now I only teach roller hockey, but we will get more diverse back into that because this just happened 2 years ago. So I'm still, but I still coach hockey. It's not very diverse, the team we're on right now, but it's my kids' team. So, but we're working on it, and you know, it's one of our main goals is to get more kids. In fact, I'm trying to get a rink built in a certain part of Des Moines. If I'm trying to get through around some politicians right now, and that's a big test. So, but we're trying to build a roller hockey rink in the urban areas. So, so sports is a huge deal. I think that's great in keeping kids on track and as a reward system. And so.
And teaching them that cooperation is this path to success.
Right. And when you're on my team, I usually will ask you to do like little things like go home and do something nice for your parents and not tell them you did it. That's such a hard, you know, so I always doing little things to build character and, you know, little tricks like that. So to make sure you tell your parents you love them for a reason. Give them a reason. Don't just say, I love you, Mom. So
now, the second thing I wanted to bring up was the fact that you worked with a... co-writer, or do you want to tell us how you found this person, or how she found you, and why you chose to work with her?
Jody was a woman who was writing another book on neo-Nazis, but grouping all these neo-Nazis together, and I was one of the people in the group. She said, and throughout her research, she had always heard my name. My name was always popping up. So when she came to interview me for this other book project, I said, hey, you know, I'm more than a chapter joke. And she was like, I heard some of your story. And so eventually she got done with that other project and she said, hey, I'm still interested in writing your book. And the real quick story with her was, you know, James Fry had just gotten called out on Oprah. So she was like, hey, I'm not going to have any lies in this book. She goes, so I want to fact check everything you say. So the first thing we do is we go to this mental hospital that I escaped from. And we went there and interviewed the people at the hospital. And their story that I told about me jumping out the windows and all this, she goes to ask them, and she's like, the people at the hospital are like, it's worse than that. This is what he did. And our whole hospital now is changed due to that escape 15 years ago.
Wow.
So,
see, what an effect you have in the world, isn't that?
It changed the whole hospital procedure. So, and then we also have the thing that we're working on today. So, if we can get into that.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You brought your friend from Des Moines.
Yes.
Christian, welcome to Writer's Voices. Okay. And your last name is Day?
Day, D-A-Y.
D-A-Y, Christian Day. Let's see. Oops, I got to get your...
Oh, there you go. On. Pull your...
Yeah,
pull,
let's try that again. Yeah, you can bring it on over here okay. So we can...
look at each other.
See you. Yeah, look at each other. So, Frank, you want to talk a little bit about this project?
So here's what we have. You know, as you could see, when I got out of the movement, I was taught, you know, I was born and raised Catholic, and then I got into the hate groups through Christianity. Like, that's how they taught us how to hate in the movement, was through Bible studies and stuff like that. When I got out of the movement, I still stayed a Christian. I just felt that was what I was, and I just believed it and was into it. But as the years went on, people like Rick Perry were coming out and other very right-wing Christian conservatives. And as I worked in that industry, when I worked in radio, I got to tell you, I started to become embarrassed that I was a Christian. And I started to not believe. And I kind of am still at that battle in my head. And I started to talk to my friend Christian about this, about how I'm so lucky that when I'm in Iowa and going through this spiritual battle, I was like, with places like Fairfield, and you have the Hindu temple in Madrid, and you have like all this great spiritual stuff that no one ever hears about Iowa.
The Abbey out in, there's a monastery.
Yeah, we're going there.
Yeah. You're going there.
So we started to talk about it, and Christian is a filmmaker. He just made a great documentary on Templeton Rye.
Yeah, about the whiskey cookers of Carroll County. And Frank and I have actually been friends for a while, and this was kind of a neat idea. It's given us this opportunity to work together. And I think, you know, the thing with religion is there's the right message that everyone's looking for. But I feel that in a lot of ways, especially with what's going on with Frank right now, is that message is not really the important. I mean, it's being... how would you say it? The message isn't really being there anymore. It's all kind of trapped behind politics and...
Hatred.
Hatred, yeah.
Gays, liberals, you know. I mean, I hear it every day from them. If I listen, you know, you hear them talking about abortions and killing, you know. It's just... And they've just taken this view, and it has totally turned me off to it. So I said, I want to try and go on this spiritual journey in life. And so Christian said, well, why don't we document it? Let's go around Iowa in the Midwest, and we'll visit Native Americans, and let's go do this.
And so Christian has had, you're a documentarian, you've made a documentary.
I made two. I'm just filmmaker in general, yeah.
Okay, and Frank has some experience in film also.
Right, I've been in a couple of films, and I also work in television now. We'll be on a major cable network soon. I have a show coming out soon.
Oh, great.
So yeah.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about the films you were in case people want to check them out.
Okay.
You were in The Experiment.
Yep.
And with someone else from Fairfield.
A couple guys from Fairfield.
A couple guys from Fairfield.
Jesse and Micah, and great guys. And we were inmates in the movie, and we were on set every day, all day, in our cell. We were inmates in the movie.
And so. Is it a drama?
It's a drama thriller. It's okay. About guys being locked up, and it's about the Stanford Experiment. If you ever see, yeah, so it's a remake of the Stanford Experiment.
Okay.
So, and then I've done a couple movies like Janie Jones with Abigail Breslin, and then I've done a bunch of TV shows. So and I've always heard I'm really good at it.
And you made a reference to American History X. What is that?
American History X was this movie that came out during my speaking time, and it a little bit mirrors my life. And some people say they did use my story for it. I say it's just. I'm gonna be really nice and say it was just coincidences.
Okay.
So I had some background in this. So when I started to talk to Christian, I started to realize that we can really plan this out. Like, I would love to do this where, you know, I go for two days living the life of a different spirituality and see if I can refine my spirituality. Because right now I'm just at this loss where there might not even be a God. The way I'm so maybe even bitter at the Christian right-wing nuts that are screaming about. I am not lying here. I heard just the other day that a guy said, he was a Christian, right-wing Christian guy, said that if Jesus were here right now, he'd be a gun owner. And that he would own a Gap. And I just think...
Mom, you need to speak to this because... My mother is a very strong Christian, and I know that she has some advice for you in this, don't you, Mom?
Well, Jesus definitely had things to say,
mm-hmm.
And he would not, you know, he would not
He would not approve of that.
He would not approve of that. And people have always used him to justify what they want.
Absolutely.
Believe.
I did it.
Yeah.
That he hated Jews, even though he wasn't a Jew. Like, I did this.
He wasn't a Jew. That's right.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, and that's going to go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to go on forever. But I just read something the other day, and I'm trying to live by this. Before I say something to somebody about somebody, is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary?
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't say yes to all three of those, then shut up.
There you go. And see, and that's I
and that's
feel,
what Jesus would do.
And that's good. And see, but I just believe that this right-wing Christian conservatism has hijacked it. Almost like Al-Qaeda has hijacked Islam.
That's right. Or the Islam.
So that's what this documentary is about.
Yeah.
It's about the Rick Perry, who's totally made my stomach turn when I even hear him say the word Jesus. Because when they say the word Jesus, it's not like, oh, Jesus. It's like, Jesus is going to kill you. You know, and I'm like, holy, oh my God. We're just, you know, my Catholic priest never said any of this. He might have said some off-the-wall stuff, you know, he's drinking
like
a lot, too.
See, he sounds like the neo-Nazi.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But now it's more widely accepted. And that's what I want to document. And I want to document that there are, that I think that you really can find peace in other religions. And that's, the Christians, the Christian conservatives are screaming, if you don't accept Jesus, you're going to hell. And that's it. There's no other talking about it. And if you listen to it, that's what you get.
Yeah.
Well, Jesus said, you can only come to the Father through me. But I believe what he meant was, because I'm going to die on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
For everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what he meant.
Yeah. But see, in those, and so that's how this documentary got started.
Yeah.
And so now we're here, and we're going to do some interviews today, not for the documentary on camera, but we're trying to find people that'll be willing to talk to us in Fairfield about spirituality. And
you shouldn't have to look very far.
Right.
So the moment we rolled into town, we're like, this is the place.
This is
the vibe is here.
I got a really good
take
here.
We're out of time. Oh. Thank you so much for being with us, Frank and Christian. And we have some final words from Caroline.
This is Horace Greeley said this once: fame is a vapor, popularity an accident, and riches take wings. The only thing that endures is character.
Mm. See you next week on Writers' Voices.
Good job, ladies.
Yeah.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.